All right.
No, I didn't know.
I'm going to call the meeting to order. Ryan, sit down, please. I don't care what you're doing. Sit down and do it, please. So I'm calling the January 26th meeting of the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council meeting to order. I apologize for the slight delay. I'm not happy that we're late, but we are 10 minutes late. We'll get over it. The first is we have an agenda in front of us. I'd love a motion to approve the agenda.
What is that?
Les, is that a dog barking?
Move to approve the agenda.
Any discussion on the agenda? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. You have in your packet the minutes from our last meeting. I would love a motion to approve the minutes of the December 13th meeting.
So moved.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. We now have an approved agenda. Are there any members who wish to report a conflict of interest with today's agenda? No conflicts of interest. Great. Bill, Executive Director's report.
In your packet, you will find a revised Outdoor Heritage Fund statement. This is in the format used by MMB. There have been some discoveries in their prior fund statement that we based our appropriations recommendations off of. The long and the short of it, the item looks like this. It's a table. And the long and the short of it is that we have a budgetary balance or a reserve of $5.324 million. It's in the green under the FY13. Mr. Chair, Mary Robison of MMB is here to discuss this and answer questions. If we could bring her forward.
That would be great.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Mary Robison, Medicine Management and Budget. MMB's fund statements project the 12 and 13 fund balances based on current law. So the copy that Mr. Becker has in your packet takes a little bit of a liberty in recreating that fund statement and then adding the amount that you are currently recommending to appropriate for the fund in 13. You'll see the green highlight of 97,420,000. If that was your appropriation amount as currently recommended, that's what would bring your fund balance for 13 down to 5,324,000. That's a pretty good reserve. MMB recommends keeping about 5% of the appropriated amount in reserve at any given year. 5% of the appropriated amount would be about $4.8 million in 13, so you're slightly above that by about $0.43 million. So that's a good spot to be in. I know there's some talk of potentially decreasing that reserve amount, playing a little bit with that recommended amount. Other funds have done that last year. I think all the other legacy funds went down to about a 3% reserve. That's not recommended because that we might have cash flow issues in the future depending on how the forecast comes in, depending on cash flow issues. So far, we haven't had a problem with these other funds because our forecasts have come in pretty spot on in terms of how they were projected, and we haven't had cash flow because some of the things have been slow to get off the ground, but that doesn't mean we won't have problems in the future. So I'm open to any questions that anyone might have.
I'd like to just dig into the cash flow a little bit because most of our projects are 2 or 3 year projects, but the cash flow from this is in the fiscal year in which it actually earns. Where would you think that we might run into a cash flow situation? Yeah.
That's a great question. And cash flow is really difficult to predict because it just depends on when people write their checks. And as you said, a lot of these projects go for multiple years. They are capital related, and so they're sort of slow, and then they happen in big chunks. So it's really difficult to predict, and that's why we would like to see a 5% reserve at the bottom line of the fund. If we get a lot lower than that, then that's the point at which we would want to potentially monitor cash flow and look at when our agency is writing their checks and things like that to prevent something like that. Personally, I wouldn't like to get into a position where we would need to monitor the fund that closely, but it is difficult to predict, and so that's what we would have to do if the fund got that close.
But we know a number of the projects are going to take 2 or 3 years, and all the money is going to be collected in the first year. I mean, there's no way the project packages that we're talking about could possibly get all their work done in the first year.
Right, that's true. And one of the limitations of the way that this is reported is that it reflects legal authority to spend.
Mm-hmm.
So in 12, what you see for all the expenditure is the amount appropriated to the agency in that year, treated as if they were going to spend it all in that year.
Right.
Plus the amount of carry forward that they have from prior year appropriations. So you're seeing the balance assuming that they are all spending all their money in 12. And you are correct, most likely that's not the case. Because agencies don't report how much they're going to carry forward, it becomes very difficult to know what the extent of that would be. So that's an ongoing question to consider as you think about the reserve.
Okay. Bill?
Cash flow is one issue. The other issue is the accuracy of the projection.
Correct.
Is 3% sufficient for the usual error?
Mr. Chairman, members, well, as I said, 5% is generally recommended to keep a sufficient cushion. So far, our forecasts have been spot on, and we haven't really needed to use that reserve. But that doesn't mean that it won't be that way in the future. As we know, our economy continues to be somewhat volatile, including sales tax revenue, which is the revenue to the fund. So we try to be as accurate as possible, and so far we've done that, but I would still stick to a recommendation of a 5% reserve if possible. One thing that I would potentially add is that the trust fund, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund that's overseen by LTCMR, they do have a formula set up, I believe it is in statute, that dictates the amount that is available to be appropriated in any given biennium. So going into the budget cycle, they know how much they can appropriate and how much is going to be left in the fund. One thing that the council might want to consider is potentially looking at creating some legal language or statutory language that designates a certain amount of reserve in any given year. If that was to be put in place, then you would know coming into the session, or at least have some guidance or structure to talk about how much would be available for reserve and how much is available to appropriate. That might be helpful in these discussions if that's something that the council was interested in doing.
Any questions? Great. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you very much.
And that concludes the executive director's report for today.
Wow. All right. Next is item 6, a discussion on lands open to hunting. And Janelle and Greg, I think this is yours to lead us through.
I'd like to have Heather start off with some background information, and then we'll turn to Janelle and Greg.
Okay.
Heather?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Bill. In December, the council staff brought together a number of agency and NGO personnel to discuss the lands open to hunting issue. We had a number of proposals that were considered in terms of how to resolve some of the issues surrounding the public taking of fish and game on certain lands, particularly those in the metropolitan area that which would have been or will be transferred to the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. Before you in the memo, we outline what those appropriations are that are in question on the first page. And on the second page, We talked about some of the statutory language that had been proposed and the council had reviewed at its last meeting that Greg and Janelle will go through. Then Dave Shedd, Assistant Director at the Department of Natural Resources, also recommended some changes to the accomplishment plan and contract language to sort of solidify the intent of the land in terms of hunting and fishing. With that, I will turn it over to Greg and Janelle.
Mr. Chairman, members, what you see is, and I think we discussed this a little bit before, with regard to the first part is with what to do on state lands. We have the constitutional language. What this does is it takes the constitutional language and clarifies in the law what it means. And we also talked in a previous meeting about how the Department of Natural Resources has fairly broad authority to manage state lands. They can just put signs up and prohibit you from entering that land or to hunt on that land. So they do have broad authority, and this would just clarify that. And also with an SNA, a little bit closed to hunting unless the commissioner opens them up. That this would just clarify for DNR plans, particularly how that when it says lands owned by the state. Basically, I think all the land that the other Heritage Fund acquires, we're not talking about easements here that are held by Bowser, but the lands that are held by the state in fee, this would apply, and those are DNR lands. Paragraph B deals with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and what this would do would allow U.S. Fish and Wildlife to manage them under the federal act that we manage their lands under now. This deals with waterfall production areas, refuges, whatever, throwing the tall grass prairie or whatever they be managed under. Now you'll see later on that there are some provisions that deal with allowing for management and then a management plan within the accomplishment plan. But I have Janelle talk about paragraph C and then as far as she wants to go on the rest.
In paragraph C is sort of a catch-all for everything else that was considered to the previous two categories. And if you remember the discussion, a couple the example of offering grazing on lands maybe that aren't state-owned, maybe a nonprofit owns them. This would allow the Commissioner of Natural Resources to sort of have that authority he has on state lands to allow the it to be closed for a particular reason, like grazing, for example. So that's sort of to get at that. And like Heather mentioned, we did meet with a number of folks, and we actually had a number of
And Mr. Chair and members, what you'll see here is there are some additional items that were discussed in that meeting, basically ways to enforce it and also to give the commissioner direction when the commissioner is dealing with other lands. And what it would do is that the grantee would have, as part of their accomplishment plan, would have basically a hunting and fishing plan, the intended uses of the property. So it would have to be part of the accomplishment plan. What they're going to be doing as far as hunting and fishing, if they're going to restrict it at all, what types of restrictions, when can they be restricted. So it would give the commissioner some guidance as to when to approve these things. If it's an approved plan and it follows the plan, then the commissioner would approve it. It also would be required in the real property interest report where basically the grantee would need to put in the report kind of a verification of the status of hunting and fishing management plan on the property. And this would apply to all lands, including DNR lands, although DNR would be fairly simple, manages the wildlife management area, and that would be it. That would be really all they would need to say. If it was an SNA, they would need to say whether it's going to be open to hunting and fishing. For the feds, they would have to say what they're going to do with those lands as far as allowing hunting and fishing, especially in refuge lands. For waterfall production areas, basically, I think they would say they're going to manage the waterfall production area. And if there would be any closures, maybe what types of things would be closed. With regard to other lands, it would be up to the non-profit or who's ever owning those lands to also include that in their accomplishment plan. And then also there is there's an enforcement of this. If they don't follow the accomplishment plan and the land is not currently being used for its intended use, the law calls for the land to be returned to the state or to be conveyed to the state at that point in time. So there is an enforcement mechanism for this also. So this would be in addition to the language you see up above. So as a part of the accomplishment plan, if somebody's going to be restricting hunting and fishing in any manner, they would need to have mechanism and a process in the accomplishment plan. And for the non-federal and non-state lands, or the non-fish and wildlife and non-state lands, then that they would also have to include in there what those situations are, and then so the commissioner for natural resources would have guidance on when to approve of those changes or not. And Mr. Chair, I think we'll just leave it at that for now. And
okay. There'll be a discussion at that. Is there a discussion? Ryan?
Does this clear up the problem? You know, we have problems with the federal government with some of the contingencies that we place in the purchases. Is this going to just exacerbate that, or can the feds live with this?
Bill?
The feds can live with it. They're here if you want them up for testimony.
Jim, thumbs up, thumbs down?
What I've heard, I haven't seen the language, but what I've heard from Greg and Janelle, it sounds fine.
We have had one person who's involved in this express some concern about the level of detail that the hunting and fishing plan would have to take, especially with regard to federal lands, because of the process to come up with the federal regulations as a public hearing process and that sort of thing. So they can't forecast the future with perfect accuracy. So there's concern about how the council implements that DNR suggestion. I think that we can come to a common agreement working our way through it.
Jim?
Bill, how much additional paperwork or how much more work was involved for the staff?
That's a good question, Mr. Chair. Jim, I think that typically these kinds of issues may add a portion of a person week to our workload, but it won't occur for every accomplishment plan. It'll only occur for a few of them. We spent on the Anoka County issue, we spent maybe three person days all total working our way through it. And I think that having this in place will cut down on the workload. We have direction, and we have a framework to work in. And so the question is better defined than it has been in the past.
Ryan?
David, both the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and DNR often, in the case of waterfowl, will establish, sometimes on an annual basis, not always permanently, waterfowl refuges to keep birds around, etc., for reasons of improving duck hunting. But I'm curious, here it says that we would require an explanation of any limitations that are more restrictive. What are the boundaries for that? Can it be we just feel like closing it this year, or what? Are there some parameters as to how they could justify closing this land?
I think that the parameters come from the council review of the project in the beginning, and then any change from its intended use would have to be okayed by the council. Greg and Janelle, does that sound right to you?
Mr. Chairman, Bill, I think I agree with you. Just to elaborate a little bit, it seems to me that as part of a plan, especially for U.S. Fish and Wildlife, you would probably want to know when they're going to do it and for what reasons that it would occur. And that may want, you may want that in the plan. Now, for state lands, again, on paragraph A, the commissioner just has broad authority to do that under state law. If it says it's a manager of the wildlife management area, and the wildlife management area's boss says that the commissioner can close an area in a duck refuge just by putting signs out, it seems to me that that's, that would just follow. With U.S. Fish and Wildlife, it could be a little more complex. They're going to manage it under the Refuge Act. You may want to know, and I think the council may want to know this in the initial application period, how it's going to be managed and under what conditions. And I think that, those would be really good questions for them.
Thank you, Greg. I was working under the assumption that the change in management was after the appropriation and the purchase. And
well, Mr. Chairman, Bill, my thought is that you may want to know in advance, though, what types of conditions there where they would be closing it, so that, as Ron mentioned, that you're not just because you know you went, this year we're going to close that area. I think you may want to know some of that going in, and to have that set up so you don't have to change the accomplishment plan every time they want to do something.
Right.
Tim?
Greg, can those negotiations, they'll be held after it gets past the council when the DNR is transferring the land and they're making an agreement on the management plan and so forth? Could they make those changes after we've seen this and the council not be aware of that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think that the council cannot be aware of that. It says that it has to, the way they manage it, they have to report every year to make sure their management is based on that plan. So they can change, they would have to come to the council to change the accomplishment plan. And then DNR, the way this is written is because you can't give them, you can't tell them when they can open and close because you're a legislative branch entity. But what this does is it allows them to come to you on the accomplishment plan and say, here's how we're going to manage it. Now, if you guys weren't going to meet for 2 months and they needed a change, the DNR could still go ahead and allow them to do whatever they're going to do, and then you would come back kind of retroactively and change the accomplishment plan to do that. I think that could be allowed under the system, because then you would still be the management plan. But if you disagreed with it, then they would have to go back and manage it differently. Timing could be everything on this, but I wouldn't want to get too lost in those details.
Right. Is there anyone in the audience that has any thoughts on this, wants to share insight? Can I sort of take the, are you?
I'd move that we forward the recommended statutory language in the memo for inclusion as an amendment into the bill.
Does that work with you, Bill, or do you want just a recommendation?
That's a perfect motion.
Okay.
I'll second that.
You don't need a second. Oh. These rules. I guess we'll take a roll call vote on this since Les is.
No, that's right.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, any action that you take on the bill today should require 9 votes to pass because you have already made a decision to.
Okay.
That 9, we need 9 votes, and if you're going to any changes to that bill, I think you need a 9-vote.
Great.
Scenario.
Thank you for that.
Les Bench.
Yes.
Ryan Bronson.
Yes.
Jim Cox.
No.
Wayne Anger.
Yes.
Jane Kingston.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Scott Rawl.
Yes.
Senator Saxon.
Yes.
Ron Shera.
Yes.
Chair Hartwell.
Yes. We have our 9 votes, I believe.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify something too before? The thought was we're going to make this effective going back to 2009 to the first appropriation so that we'll make it retroactive to that to make sure we clean up all the past appropriations that they all have to fall into the same.
How do we do that?
We just put a retroactive effective date in.
Okay.
I'll take care of it.
So it wasn't a perfect motion. It was almost perfect.
It was almost.
I just wanted to clarify that was, we had talked about it at a previous meeting, making it retroactive, but it doesn't show on the sheet here. I just wanted to make sure everybody remembers that.
Okay.
That was the discussion.
Great. So next, we want to do a presentation on Asian carp. And we have Peter Sorensen and Tim Schlagenhoff here to talk about Asian carp.
I want to point out that Commissioner Landwehr is also in the audience in the event that we need a an appeal.
I think he came to just watch.
After Wolves this morning, he's looking for something non-controversial like carpet.
Mr. Chair, in your packet, there are a number of items relative to Asian invasive carp. There's the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District letter. There is a proposal from Professor Sorensen, and there's a discussion discussion item memo. There's a memo from Les Bench, and that's it on this subject.
All right, looks like we're operational. Thank you very much for having me back. I appreciate the support and suggestions of Les Bench and Senator Ingebrigtsen and the staff here. And my associate Dean, we even helped edit this document. So I've come back with a revised proposal, refined proposal to develop capability of moving forward in proactive ways to deal with invasive species issues for the next few decades in the state of Minnesota. And I think it's necessary and timely, and I'll give a little presentation on that. Kind of short, well, maybe 15 minutes, so hopefully there'll be plenty of time for questions. And you should certainly feel free to interrupt me as I go along. That's no problem at all. And so some of the slides are the same, and some are slightly different. So first off, the beginning's the same. What is an invasive species? It's typically defined as this is actually an executive order, non-native introduced species whose introduction does or is likely to cause economic, environmental, and or problems to human health. The sea lamprey, which ravaged and still causes problems in the Great Lakes, is a really good example, but we've got others now, such as zebra mussel, that I'll be talking about today. This slide I've shown you before, but in Minnesota, we're both, frankly, we're very lucky, but ultimately we are very threatened here. And the reason is that we're at the confluence of two watersheds. We're at the upper end of the Mississippi, and we also abut against the Great Lakes watersheds, which are now connected to the Mississippi, unfortunately, as well. And that's how we got zebra mussel and so forth. The good news is that we're at the very top end of these systems. So, frankly, the issues you're seeing now, other states saw some time ago. So we can see it coming, and it hasn't reached, although it's not exactly a great situation here, we haven't reached the point that it's going to go eventually. So there's time still. That's what I'm trying to say. And so that's the good news. The bad news is that being at the top end of this thing, ultimately we're going to be a focal point. And there's over 180 invasive species in the Great Lakes right now, and 140 plus. They're coming in all the time in the Mississippi River. The connections between these systems and the fact that there's a lot of trade and recreational boating and fishing is what's driving this. It's just it's a floodgate, basically, and it's pretty hard to restrict. And the situation actually goes back some time, and these are just the ones that I'm going to briefly allude to today. But the first wave really hit us in the late 1880s, as a matter of fact, with the common carp on the top left, which is an issue my lab's working with now and finally starting to resolve. More recently, the silver carp you see in the middle left, the Asian carp, which are coming up, and ultimately, unfortunately, there's a snakehead further downstream, which is sort of building up in mass in Arkansas and areas like that, that unfortunately we've got to look forward to. As you know, the zebra mussel are here, and behind them, we know this from looking at across the country, are the quagga mussels. We received curly leaf, it seems actually at the same time as common carp, in the, which is a really nasty invasive plant. It chokes lakes in the late 1880s. Then we received the milfoil and then hydrillus after that. So this is not a situation that there's a one-time fix or anything like that. It's a change in how we live, and we have to adjust how we deal with it. So I'm sure you've all got that message. But the situation is, and I showed this slide before, is this, to me, looking at it as a scientist, it's a war. It's a continuum. It's a change in paradigms. Change. It's a permanent change in how we're using the environment. It's not a just one battle with the Asian carp or the zebra mussel. It's a series of things. The stakes are extremely high because right now, part of what I'm talking about, once they get in, we have no way of getting them out. Conventional approaches have not worked well at all, if at all. There is nothing in the toolbox, you can talk with Tim here, that really allows us to deal with these things. These are animals from other locations that work in different ways, so we don't have a good understanding of them, let alone tools to deal with them. And working in water is extremely difficult because you can't see in water. So this even really muddies the situation further. So that's kind of the scenario. And it's a difficult one. But there have been some successes, and I showed this slide to you before. In the actually about 1920s, the sea lamprey got to the Great Lakes and reached a crisis point in the 1940s. All the fisheries collapsed, and with about a 10-year program, more or less, of basic science, screening thousands of compounds, we found a compound that specifically, it's not perfect, but knocks down the sea lamprey, and that's why there's still fish to fish in the Great Lakes today. It's the science that was done in the 50s, the far-sighted science that just decided they were going to go after it. Okay, and as you know, lake trout have come back, at least to some extent, a lot of the fisheries have come. Another example I like to use is from my own lab, but since about early 2005, we've been working on common carp, and now we've found some Achilles heels and their recruitment cycles, the places where they have young, that allows us to control recruitment processes, the birth of young, by actually enhancing game fish populations, so that's a winning situation. And we've also discovered, Pajamic Buyer, my lab is back there, also discovered that they aggregate in really dense aggregations that allows us sometimes in a single day to remove very substantial portions of the population. But it took us a while to get there, and it was through sort of a route of inquiry. So I guess I just sort of said this, but again, conventional approaches didn't work with common carp, didn't work with sea lamprey. Knowledge was critical, detailed knowledge. Every species has its weakness. I mentioned this before. Everything dies eventually. Nothing's perfect. There's weaknesses. So the trick is to say that we know they're there. Let's just go find them. Sometimes they're easy to get. Sometimes they're not, but they're there. And sometimes, and this is the real key, these things are coming from thousands of miles away, different habitat, different types of environments, sorts of situations that people here aren't used to or trained to deal with. So you've got to kind of go to a different dimension to think about it. In both cases, sea lamprey, which is from the Atlantic Ocean, for heaven's sake, for instance, hanging off sharks and whales and stuff like this. So to kind of get at that, you had to think really differently. So that's what research is all about, is looking a little bit more foresight, you know, into the distance and exploring different sorts of things. So that's why you need research to deal with invasive species. Of course, you need control as well, but you absolutely need it. So what's the way forward? Looking at it from a management perspective, and I think I showed this slide before, I see sort of five steps. One, of course, prevent introduction at all, altogether. And what I'm saying is while you're doing that, you should anticipate that effort can never be 100%. It's just human nature. Nothing's perfect. So while we're trying to prevent introductions, the DNR is doing a great job with that. This state is known throughout the country, actually, for its preemptive efforts with the DNR, preventing movement of invasive species and so forth. But while you're doing that, you have to realize eventually some joker is going to bring something in somewhere, or maybe a bird will fly overhead and drop it. It's going to happen. So you have to be looking for, unfortunately, looking ahead strategically. So while you're stopping introduction, you should be looking for ways to delay that invasion when it occurs. While you're looking to, you should be seeking ways to delay the invasion. And as you do that, you should realize that you can't hold them back forever. No barrier is perfect, and some of this is just nature, flooding, so forth like that. Some of it's people doing crazy, stupid things you can't control. But in any case, you have to do that. So you want to prevent introduction, delay invasion, reduce the numbers, control, and ultimately, and this is an argument I like to make, but not everyone agrees, I think you should be thinking about eradication. Some people think you should take it off the table. I don't. I think it's possible. There are examples of it. I think you've always got to have that dream out there that you can actually fix this. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. And that would be the objective of this center that I'm proposing, would be explore all those options with the DNR so that we can look forward, look to the future and be preemptive and deal with some issues we have right now. So, and to seek real solutions, not just sort of Rube Goldberg types of things, but real things. And I guess that it shows up okay. So the idea would be that we would interface with the DNR really actively. In fact, in this proposal I've now developed, there's an extension position that could work directly, perhaps even within the DNR, to kind of get some technology transfer and some ideas coming from academic and research circles, get that flow going. I'm not saying we've got all the solutions, but sometimes we get a good idea, you know. So it's nice to get it going there. And then also we connect with our various other international and national research institutes that are working with invasive species, and that would be kind of the role that I see this thing. So I go through it, and you have a document that lays it out. And so the first thing would be I have a slide each one of these points, to develop understandable monitoring techniques. In other words, deterrent techniques, barriers, control techniques, eradication, statistics to interpret these data, because this is all very confusing and complex, and then lastly, an extension position. This would be kind of a novel position, but I think it's really important. This is a great example of where more communication from research labs into the general flow of state fisheries and wildlife agencies, I think couldn't hurt. I think it could be very helpful. So first off, I'll talk about reliable monitoring techniques. As you've probably been following the papers, we've been using, first off, we caught, commercial fishermen caught some Asian carp in Mississippi and St. Croix rivers, but no one knew what it meant. So the DNR went out and they hired a contractor, and I think just rightly so, to see if there was DNA, eDNA, of these carp in the water. That's a great thing to do because fish are like cats or something. You can't see them. They're very hard. I'm a terrible fisherman. It's really hard to systematically actually sample in the water for things that are swimming around that you can't see. So chemicals are a great way to go. But as you know, these tests are very difficult to interpret. So right now we've got this. I've got an example here on the right here of what's been happening. And we've talked with Tim quite a bit. Lauren Miller at the U, who's the employee, does too. It's like, what does it mean if you've got a positive... If you measure DNA in the water, is that one silver carp, means something that's just spurious, or is it 1,000 spawning frantically? You know, honestly, we don't know. Were they here last week, or are they here today? We don't know. Furthermore, these tests take months to come in, and that's a little bit, and no one can go out and repeat it right away. So we are suggesting that the university has these, for heaven's sake, you know, we're a leader in all kinds of molecular biology. This tech expertise could be housed right within the university and work with other institutions to kind of develop this to get a much more efficient and rapid and comprehensible and testable way of monitoring animals. If you don't know how many are there, how are you going to deal with these silver carp? it's really difficult. So, and I kind of, you know, feel for the people kind of dealing with this because it's such an unknown. So we want to develop a center that would do this and actually look at some new techniques at the same time, specifically designed for local species and local situations, and that it could be efficient and act quickly. So that was one point. And I've broken these down into different budget items. Another thing we'd like to work with, and we have experience with this with LCCMR funding, is new deterrence techniques. And as you're going to hear shortly, we're now thinking of some kind of barrier to stop Asian carp moving up the river, which is a great idea. We've got to do something. I certainly agree on that. But if you ask me how effective this is going to be, I really don't. Nobody knows anywhere in the planet. Nobody knows. We know that they'll work, that they'll stop a certain percentage, and this is extrapolated for some, frankly, pretty hypothetical lab situations, such as we're doing, but nobody knows. So I would submit this is a worthwhile investment of funding to try and document this stuff, and we can do it. We have now two operating air curtain systems at the university. One is in the outdoor stream lab built through civil engineering in the bottom right-hand corner, which is showing about 70 to 80 stoppage levels of common carp. We haven't had a chance to test Asian carp. And I'll show you a picture in a second. We're actually going to build one in Ramsey, Washington watershed at their request over the course of this winter to develop this. So not only do we want to develop this, because these things, frankly, were also developed for marine power plants in the UK. That's where this technology came from. That's part of the problem here. They weren't designed for Asian carp. They weren't optimized for Asian carp. We're trying to make two fit. But the price is very high if it doesn't fit. So let's figure it out. And also we'd like to look at some other alternatives, such as blockage systems for small tributaries or even main rivers where we know these conventional barriers can't work or simply unaffordable. For instance, this one I'll show you here, which we're going to be putting at the top end of Lake Phalen, only costs $20,000. And that's designed with a sliding arm. This was designed by Dan, a PhD student in civil engineering. So it'll be a position to kind of develop that at the U. And I'm not sure how well it's going to work, but it's not costing a lot to find out. And if it does work, this, I think, could revolutionize how we're dealing with a lot of these carps, which, I should point out, have a sense of hearing that's about 50 times more acute than native fishes. So that's why sound. That's why bubbles, because they have a great sense of hearing, and they're very sensitive fish. This is an area that you can target. It's an Achilles heel. Okay, so that would be a second position, jointly housed with civil engineering, and there are great facilities down there. Third would be develop some new control techniques, which we're already doing at the U, particularly with fish within the fisheries department. But we have no expertise at all in zebra mussel. There's nobody, as far as I know, at Madison, there's a guy working on zebra mussel. So that's the closest where you can get a PhD level researcher kind of who's actively working with zebra mussels in this part of the country. There's nobody in the state. So we would like to propose, and I think this is really needed, to bring somebody here, set up a new lab. This is brand new. And to search for Achilles heels within zebra mussel. Now, nobody knew when they started with sea lamprey how long this would take, but they got it. I couldn't tell you how long it's going to take with zebra mussel either, but there's got to be something that gets these things. They're not from here. Everything has its weakness and strength. So we would bring in new expertise to start looking at this and develop a lab where we could test different things under controlled situations to provide guidance and a way forward and at least some hope that something can eventually kind of work itself out. And I'm hopeful that it actually will. I'm a scientist, so I'm biased, but I have great faith in these things. I think we've done some great things. And done some bad things, too, but we've done some great things. So this zebra mussel thing is really important. That's got a very sizable chunk of the budget that I'm proposing and several people working within it. We can talk about the details if you want. We also would like to create a fish ecology position here. We already have this, but we'd like to formally sort of make it more permanent. Look for natural controls with common carp. particularly whether and how ecosystem management and game fish might be able to control by through predating on them on young and recruitment. This is working with common carp. No one's had a chance. I know Tim is interested in it, but we'd like to have ARENA to test this out formally to see if and how it might work. This would be a new area of established excellence within the state. It's a fairly ambitious proposal, but this is a daunting task we're facing. Also, we continue our work. This is frankly funding for myself. Continuing work on fish behavior and physiology, looking at sound, the chemical attractants, repellents, specific things. These fish work in different sensory worlds than you and I. They see different things than you and I. Their eyes work differently. Their sense of smell works differently. This is why when you go fishing, you can use certain types of baits. There's things out there. The Asian carp are difficult because they're planktivorous. They're going to be doing something really different. That's both a challenge, but it's actually got great promise because it means that there's something different to target. You've got to look for it. So that is that what this would be about and various aspects of that, as well as tracking the specifics of their movement and understanding that, which has been very insightful for common carp, frankly. The chaos of common carp movement in the spring now makes sense for us, and we can predict it, manipulate it, and actually use it to remove them. And lastly, this is a continuation, sort of strengthening an area already existing at the U on invasive plant control with Professor Newman there. And he's been very interested in ecosystem management, and he's discovered an insect, for instance, that specifically controls milfoil, and whether and how that might be used. So that would be part of this. So that would be the sort of control part. Can stop for a second if anyone has any questions about that. But I see the zebra mussels, the big new part, and that's very, looking at it from your perspective, well, from my perspective too, I think that's what the state, well, it means a lot of things, but definitely it's that. Lastly, this is perhaps what some people might say the blue sky, but eradication. And this is, frankly, I've discovered the university is a world center in global disease control. We have a $30 million program that's right now focused on ag animals and birds across the globe, actually looking to prevent disease. But those same efforts could be used to look for viruses, that species-specific viruses that might control specific species. And this, some of you may know the story, there's actually precedent for this. Rabbits got into Australia in the early 1900s, and within a few decades, there were almost a billion rabbits. They outnumbered people by, like, well, I don't know what the numbers would be, about 10, 20 to 1, something like that. Nobody knew what to do. And the way rabbits are now controlled in Australia is with the virus. They introduced myxomatosis virus and then later coeces virus. And the Australians are actually now working on fish viruses for carp for the same reason. I'm in communication with them about this. And it's not altogether impossible that this could work. But that's the light at the end of the tunnel. That's one option. And I would like to propose a slot for that, as well as continuing support of Nick Phelps there, who's working on VHS, which is an exotic virus that now threatens Minnesota fishes. And some of you may know about it. It's surrounding us. It's in Wisconsin. We want to keep it out. So that's a little bit more high tech, but that's I think it's important to have an end, see an end. We also want to do this rigorously, and if and as we develop treatment protocols and sample things like the eDNA, we want to do this statistically in a defensible manner that makes good scientific sense. And so we've asked for a small amount of money here to maintain a lab that would specialize in modeling of invasive species and sampling and control techniques to guide the DNR to use the limited resources most effectively. This is what financial markets do all the time, right? This is, well, got the same kind of problem here with these species all over the place. And then lastly, and I think this is very important, none of this is any good if it all stays within the heads of scientists or even scientific journals at the U. People don't often read or know where to go to read things. We would like a really prominent position through extension to which could even be housed with the DNR. I've talked with them a little bit about this, to work with them and us and between us and the various stakeholders to take this collect it and take this information and apply it, and maybe even work in the field in sort of a scientific setting to help collect stuff. So that, I mean, the DNR has people like this, I know, and they're very good, but this would be a PhD kind of person that would be really in tune with what was published last week and what's happening to you, you know, last month. So that would be the idea there. And the budget now, I'm sorry, it's gone up, but my dean sat down with me. We had a serious talk. And so we need about $2 million in startup funding for these new labs, new positions, startup money, and it's about $2 million for what I've described today. It would be about $2 million, slightly less, per year to run all that. And obviously, there's, you know, different ways of skinning a cat, but that's kind of, this is an honest appraisal of what I think, frankly, really kind of at a minimum, the state needs to protect and conserve the resources for our next generations, and we have to just get on this. And it's a lot, but it'll be some good science, and it would put us at the forefront and instead of behind the eight ball all the time. So that's a little summary. So I think this is really necessary, and I know this from actually 16 years working with Great Lakes and sea lamprey, working down in Australia. This is how other programs work. They have a certain fraction that they dedicate to dealing with problems today, and a certain portion they say, and this is what we're putting aside for tomorrow so that we can deal with it, because we can't develop tools immediately. We need really new things. So the cutting edge science, multifaceted, see, got a typo there. There'll be an extension component that I hope, fully expect it would complement work with the DNR in particular, but other agencies and groups. And it'd be real flexible, so we could handle different sorts of things coming through. So that's my presentation, and I welcome any comments or questions.
Ryan?
Peter, thank you for proposing this. I'm one of those that says it's about time we got after this. I have a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to do one at the moment, but you've been working on carp for quite a few years. Very fascinating work using bluegills to control carp, but I've been curious about, in your mind, how applicable is what you've discovered in controlling carp, how applicable is that on a greater stage across Minnesota?
Great question. I think it's applicable because at least we understand the mechanisms that grow, that drive carp abundance now. So we know where to look and how to target the recruitment sources where the young come from. I think about, hard to say, a third to half the places I think are treatable, frankly, because the Lake Phalen system is a perfect example. We found all the carp coming to that system are coming from a little water treatment pond that's just a few acres that have been neglected for decades. And just by putting a $20,000 barrier out. So what we found was that the carp migrate between places, but the young, and they spawn every year, but the young only come from a few restricted areas that are generally degraded, as a matter of fact, and lack predatory fish. So I think our work is pretty broadly applicable, perhaps not every instance, but pretty broadly applicable. And talking with people working with Asian carp, I think it will ultimately be applicable there. You don't evolve to have several million young a year unless there's a reason. These animals have evolved to have that many eggs and that many young because typically, the typical scenario where they're from, they don't all survive. Something's getting them. So this has been one of our main thrusts. And I think there's good evidence for similar scenarios in Asian carp. And degradation of aquatic environments has really played in the hands of a lot of these animals. There's no predatory control for them.
Right. A follow-up there. With that thought in mind, one of your suggestions was to slow down the spread of Asian carp, and you mentioned the bubbler system, etc. Mm-hmm. And it all makes sense to slow them down, but with that kind of reproductive potential, if a few get through, have we accomplished anything?
Well, that's a great question. We may have, because all I can tell you is with Common Carp, it's very similar. They have 1 to 3 million eggs a year. They live to be 50 or 60 years old. And we find that routinely, most lakes in the state, will have that many eggs, not a single one will survive. So the lake systems, when they're healthy and robust and have all these little predatory fish around, actually control that situation. So the numbers can be deceiving, and that's why a statistician is useful. It's difficult numbers to go through, but I can tell you, Lake Riley, for instance, I think that was the one you were out on. Although there were 4,000 carp out there, several billion eggs released every year, not one had survived in 15 years. And then we took out this little wetland, and it's been solved since. So, you got to look a little deeper. Yeah.
Jim?
Professor Sorensen,
yes.
On Ron's point there, but when we're dealing with major rivers now,
right,
and we're talking about these barriers, which
right.
is what we've
really
been asked of. And these barriers are not always going to be in operation. They're not always going to be even
right.
even when they're under normal circumstances. There's going to be a lot of days when they're not even operational.
Right.
Do we have any assurance at all that we'll be able to prevent these fish in great enough numbers to make a difference, or are we just is this just false security is really what
well,
we're promoting
if
here?
If you think it's a permanent fix, it's false security. If you think it's buying yourself some time, it's money well invested. I think it behooves us to do what we can and to deter them. Frankly, the carp have been down in Illinois since early 1990s, and they can swim a couple hundred kilometers a day. So there's dynamics here that are very complicated that aren't very well understood. So deterring some, and there are critical numbers they have to reach to reproduce that we don't understand. This is kind of why we just need information. We don't really have questions. But I think there's a good chance that deterring large numbers of most of the population from getting up may prevent them reaching critical mass. Because one of the things about these fish, and we don't really understand it, but it's not uncommon for fish, is going to be like a threshold. And once you get over that, then all of a sudden the population explodes. And this happened in the Kansas River not long ago, for instance. So, my suggestion would be do what's reasonable to delay them, and then with all, due course, try to get beyond that, save enough money. I mean, of course, biased here, but save enough money that you can build a second wall of defense behind that while you're shoring up the first one. Does that make some sense?
It makes some sense, but then you think of all the tributaries coming off these major rivers that are going to be unprotected, that are all interconnected. And you just look at carp in this state, how long the waterfowl communities tried to stop these common carp on non-navigable waters, and it's been an abject failure.
Right.
I guess I'm just still, have a real problem with barriers as any kind of a realistic...
Well, I don't like to use the word barrier. I like to use the word deterrent. You notice I was using that there.
Okay.
I'm using that for a reason. That's because I think it can be part of a solution, and it can be useful. But if that's why we've had so many problems with wetlands in Minnesota, if people just put up a barrier and walk away from it, or poisoned by it, it's not fixed. But if you rebalance that ecosystem, this is what we're finding, we can get more permanent solutions into place. And the problem with common carp, part of it was nobody really understood where they were moving and why, or where the young were coming from. So it was a very unfocused effort. And what you don't want to do is lose forest for the trees. A big large fish jumps, you can watch it, but don't remember. The question is how many are under the water, and in particular, are any of those reproducing? So that's what we've got to sort of start to figure out here, get some numbers, do the math.
Just one other quick question. Have any of the other 12 or so states in the Mississippi River done any of this work at all? Have any of them tried to put up barriers of any sort of, have any experience whatsoever?
Well, of course, the famous ones, the Chicago Ship Canal, which is seems to be sort of working, even though there's DNA above it. There's no evidence of reproduction above it.
And why have none of the other states tried to do anything at all?
Do you know anything?
Yeah, the biggest barrier, electrical barrier, has been the Chicago Ship Canal. But unlike on the main stem of the Mississippi and the major tributaries, I think they've come kind of the same conclusion that we have, that at best you're going to slow them down, and a lot of those fish are passed. The fisheries community of all the upper river states, they have talked extensively over many years now about how can we stop the fish from moving upstream. And on a big river system like that, it is very, very difficult. And
it's very hard.
Like Peter said, you might be able to slow them down for a while. I think it's a matter of looking where you're looking at your investments. You know, knowing that you're not going to permanently stop those fish from getting up a big river. There may be small tributaries, things like we're describing here, that you could effectively protect a lake or things like that. But long-term, the big river systems, the fish are just too capable of moving past. The technologies aren't there, or they're way too expensive.
But I should add, no one's really taken a hard look at this. So these systems we're looking at, they were designed for other things in other places. No one's really, you know, focused in on saying, you know, here's an Asian carp. What does it see? What does it smell? What do we get to stop it? How many do we have to stop? I mean, that question's never really been asked.
Just one other quick question. Are these Asian carp, are they a warm water fish? I mean, is our colder water any kind of a deterrent?
I don't believe so. They go into some pretty cold water up in China, and unfortunately there's no reason to believe colder waters. The one thing that might hold them back is what I was talking about before. Not hold them back, but prevent them from going to a boom cycle, is that the eggs are released in streams, and they take a few days to hatch. So they need a certain sort of period of time floating in an open river to hatch, where the eggs will die. So that's one thing maybe that's good. There's some hope there. You know, there's this phenomenon in fisheries, kind of like, you know, you release all these eggs, and let's say you have a predator population that can eat 10 billion eggs. So, you know, if there's only a few thousand silver carp there, or common carp, then they can handle that number. But once you reach a certain threshold, then it explodes. And this is commonly observed. And I do think it's worth trying to hold them back. But, again, you view it as a deterrent and not as a permanent fix. And let's look for something else, a disease, or an attractant or something that might, an aggregant, something that might. And that, frankly, that work is one thing people, it's worth understanding that almost all the federal dollars are going into preventing those carp from getting into the Great Lakes. I mean, that's the federal initiative, and getting past that barrier system. So there isn't that much work going on in alternative things, and we're being left out a little bit of this equation.
Jane?
I'd appreciate it if you could compare and contrast your proposed research facility to the Fish and Wildlife Lab in Crofts. What some fundamental difference? I take it the zebra mussel would be one big difference.
Yeah, so that's a great question. We would focus entirely on state of Minnesota issues, not federal issues. Okay, so that's I think one really big issue. We would answer to the state of Minnesota, not to.
I mean more in terms of the work.
So yeah, okay. Yeah. So the work. So zebra. So let's start at the top here. I'm not aware of any work they have going on in barrier systems at all. They may have some, but I'm not a fin down there, but I'm not aware of any. In fact, I believe we're the only lab in the United States working on acoustic barrier systems. And we have a whole civil engineering company, department here, and St. Anthony Falls Laboratory, which is the only lab of its kind in the world. You know, Priest of the Mississippi literally goes through that facility where you can design and test and develop things. That's a pretty unique facility and opportunity. So we have that for the deterrence. The La Crosse Lab is developing monitoring systems, but it's not operational yet. And I'm not really quite sure what their focus is going to be, but it will eventually be on Asian carp, but they're at least a year out. They don't have anything I think there's a guy working on it a little bit in the lab, but they don't have anything running right now.
Would that be a redundancy?
I would hope not. I sent them our proposal, and we've talked with them. It shouldn't be. There's really plenty of issues and need for this kind of stuff. So we would continue to talk with them, and we would focus on things that we think we're particularly powerful on, which, you know, University of Minnesota is, you know, whatever, 20,000 scientists versus a couple dozen in La Crosse. So, I mean, I'm looking to is mine the biotechnologies, frankly, bring that stuff out. That really, I look at this like a health, human health person might. This is a cancer of the environment. We're going to have to really go out there and look for some novel, innovative, technologically advanced solutions, perhaps, for some of these things. And the university is in a really good position, excellent position to do that. So I don't think there should be any significant redundancy with the La Crosse lab. And I sent Mark Gladwood, the guy in charge, I sent him our proposal a couple of days ago, and he's looking at it. And he says he would work. I've got a letter from him here actually saying he'd work with us on it. So so that would be the detection thing. Then we've got the Terrence thing. The zebra mussel thing, I don't believe they have anything going on there now. Eventually they could. That actually, when I was with Sea Lamprey Control, I used to work with them down there. They developed a lot of our assays for us, so I'm familiar with them. And we can work with them again. They have some pretty nice toxicology setups, and I'm not proposing to build them here again. So we could do that. Zebra mussel would be novel. They're not; they don't have the capability of working in the field the way we do. We have lots of lakes and rivers around here, and students that go out with the behavior and fish ecology networks here that are pretty different than what they would have. I'm not aware of them doing anything with plants exactly. What they are doing with Asian carp is they're developing biocides for that would poison them, trying to get them to eat them. And frankly, they're coming to us for expertise on how to flavor these things to make the carp eat them. So I know them. I've worked with them. Then the disease part here, the eradication, that of course is just this is one of the few places in the world we could do that. That's well out of the way. So there's I think there's a lot of room to complement work with them, and I would look to do that. So and then
Wayne?
Extension, of course.
Wayne, thank you.
You mentioned it, I think, in your budget, or you're looking at like about $2 million to get started.
And yes.
Of course, I always wonder exponentially if you had $10 million, your chances for success be five times greater because you're going to go five times faster. So quite frequently, we put Band-Aids on projects.
And, right.
And I'm trying to figure out whether we are, if this is significant enough, where we try to join forces with everybody possible to try to find a solution. Not just a permanent, a temporary
fix. Well, you're asking a great question. To some extent, things can only move at certain rates. You know, you're looking for a discovery.
Mm-hmm.
What I've asked for would basically be to repair and fix all the rundown facilities, at least get them operational again, because we're kind of not in good shape. And to go beyond that, we'd probably need a whole building or something. Really. Sure it would accelerate stuff. I think this country needs something like this. Other countries have things like that. The center that I'm part of in Australia gets $60 million a year for a national. And carp are considered one of the most noxious species common carp down there. And they take it very seriously. So they have high-level fish disease labs working with genetically engineering viruses and so forth. So it needs to be, but maybe we can set the example here and make Minnesota a leader and just push forward with it.
Mr. Chair, I just have a follow-up question.
Okay.
And that one, you probably can't answer. Maybe I'll have to rely on the commissioner to take care of that one. But I was just curious. We've been working with carp and purple loosestrife and thorn and emerald ash borer and all kinds of invasives here recently. And I'm wondering what the overall budget impact is for control of all these things together, whether the DNR has a budget that is exclusively designed for invasives and also what the university, between the two of them, how many dollars are we spending now? No particular budget?
We members of the Council, Tom Heimer, D.R. Commissioner. If you think of invasive broadly, it includes thistles. Right? And when you start thinking about, you know, the nature of that, there's no way we account specifically for that. We do land treatments, we do water treatments. There's no specific budget for all invasives. What we have right now for aquatic invasive species through our program through the Ecological Park Resources is in the neighborhood of about $8 million a year. And that's for primarily zebra mussels at this point in time. There's ongoing programs with aquatic plant management, evolving programs with Asian carp. But I'd say if you're looking at $8 million, that might be the aquatic end of it.
Thank you.
Danny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Soxon, for your great work and for the presentation today. That helps a lot, and I certainly hope this group and the legislature can find a way to fund your work and expand on it. We need to do that. You know, unfortunately, a normal track maybe for you to be funded would be LCCMR, but unfortunately, decisions made in the last couple of years to go to a every two-year funding.
Right.
We don't have that opportunity here, but hopefully we can find a way to work that in potentially. And we're certainly looking at other options to help with your endeavors. My questions center around something that might be more appropriate in the discussion we're going to have more from the DNR. We currently have some funding for Asian carp in our current Lassard Sams bill, and we understand there's potentially significant federal match available potentially for some deterrence on the lock system to help with our money. Mm-hmm. But it's probably not enough to put a deterrent at Lock and Dam number two. It would probably make more sense if we only had the funding to put deterrence at Lock and Dam one and St. Anthony and get some redundancy in those two and protect the upper Mississippi. That leaves open, wide open, the dirty water of the Minnesota, which is great
right.
for carp.
Right.
What are your thoughts that the state of Minnesota would be willing to spend a dollar per person and put a temporary deterrent, for instance, in Lock and Dam 2, say it would cost $6 million. If you were king for a day, what are your thoughts on that?
For 5 minutes, my first thought would be actually to sit down and come up with a little bit more of a plan here. I think if it turns out, and I don't really know, well, I'm not answering this correct, I think that's worth looking at. And the reason I think that's worth looking at is because it's not clear to me, although we have apparently a few large carp swimming around because we're picking up their DNA, it's not clear to me that there's enough of them yet that they've crossed some kind of threshold, so it's not too late to invest in something a little more preemptive on there. But I would encourage, again, a strategy that was multifaceted and looked at this as a deterrent while we built up some more permanent solution. And it's not too late. That's kind of what I'm saying. If they were really here, you would know it. Believe me, I've seen them in the Illinois River. They're not here like that. So they're not. They're here all right, but there's still time. So I think Lock and Dam number two should still be seriously considered. But that's a little bit more risky, and if you can do that, then we really need a comprehensive long-term plan, specifically realizing that that's not a permanent. It's not a solution. It's delaying tactic. But that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Sorensen, a follow-up. Would if DNR could find a way to patch together right away an RFP to install an electrical barrier in Lock and Dam 1 and or St. Anthony with the potential that it actually could be operational prior to the shipping season, does that make sense to pursue something like that if it's possible?
Well, I think it's worth considering. Again, my perspective would be if it bankrupted the system so that you couldn't pursue any type of work I've been proposing that would deal with the problem when they eventually get through that electrical barrier, because they will eventually, that would be folly. but it's at least worth looking at it. You know, I think so. I mean, I think it's important to do so.
Well, and just very finally, Mr. Chair, thank you. Dr. Sorensen, I think your work is the most important that we find a way to do, but the short-term availability of some deterrence would really be beneficial, because the reality, your work is going to take years to take place, and we're looking at the real issue that a potential deterrent may help your work.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Deterrent is important. It's not too late, so we should deter it. That's reasonable, but don't bankrupt the system while you do so. And also, very importantly, if you put a deterrent in, it should be very carefully monitored and studied so we understand how well it's performing, how much time we have, and what it's really doing. And this has been the history of barriers. People put them in and walk away from them, and you know, eventually the fish get over it, and nobody really knew what happened. So no one learns from it. I don't know if this is rambling is helping you at all, but I think it's very important to do something, move ahead, and have a long-term plan. And I guess what struck me is the first time I really got serious about this was I went to Australia in 2005. I went there, and first of all, I was astonished how seriously they're taking common carp, because people here have given up on them. And I said, why are you doing this? And they said, well, you know what, this isn't actually for us. This is for our grandchildren. And we have a 40-year plan. And that's how we're looking at this. And I think that's a little bit broader scale than what we need here, but that kind of perspective is very valuable, because that is the time. These fish live to be 40, 50, 60 years old. So that's, you've got to think longer term and big picture. That's the way they operate. It's their game.
So I'd like to ask Tim and Tom, you guys are sort of on the front lines in terms of barriers. You've come to us asking for funding for barriers. This is a fast-moving kind of debate as to what should be done. What's your current thinking?
Yeah, okay. Tim Schlagna, I'm with the DNR out of our Lake City office. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. And last time we met and set that funding aside, we had said that we wanted to look into the feasibility of these barriers. And we've been doing exactly that. We've been evaluating whether or not they make sense at several locations. Upper St. Anthony Falls, Lock and Dam 1, Lock and Dam 2, and the mouth of the St. Croix River. All things that have been discussed a little bit this morning. There are a number of studies that have been done, very comprehensive studies over the last several years that evaluated these technologies. And we've relied on those studies. And from those, we've focused our efforts on a couple of technologies, electrical barriers, and also combinations of sound, bubble, and light, things like Dr. Sorensen was talking about. And throughout this evaluation, we believe that our best long-term option from an ecological perspective and effectiveness perspective is to have the opportunity to close a lock at Upper St. Anthony Falls if those fish are an imminent threat and they show up. That prevents all fish from passing through. There is no deterrent technology failures that occur. That is obviously very complicated and costly in other regards as well, but that remains, that was the site of a permanent fish barrier and is our best option. There are opportunities, though, we believe, at other sites. We believe Lock and Dam 1 and 4 Dam, that lock chamber provides our best opportunity, because the only way fish can get through that site is to lock through. There's not a gated dam there. It's similar to Upper St. Anthony Falls, and it's also similar to Lock and Dam 19 down in Keokuk, Iowa, which we're talking about for other species that haven't gotten up here. All of the other dams on the Mississippi are gated dams that they pull the gates out of water when the flows get high and the fish can pass through. Regarding the Ford Dam, we are meeting with the Corps of Engineers, and we're identifying what issues and concerns they have. This is not a simple process. It's likely to extend well into the 2012 navigation system season. They have concerns about safety. They have concerns about their infrastructure. They're required by law, I think it's a 408 permitting process that they have to follow by law to ensure the integrity of their structure, and that takes time. We are trying to accelerate that. They're interested in accelerating that with us, and so we are meeting actively with them to try to determine how to get that done as soon as possible. We would like to get specific proposals for both electrical and sound bubble type barriers. Depending on who you talk to, you get different perspectives on costs, long-term maintenance, safety. So that all needs to be, I think, brought to us by a consultant that actually do this kind of work. And I think I found out the legislature is actually looking into this, so we are going to be receiving a proposal for the electrical side of this. Lock and Dam 2, and we talked about that, and Representative Macker, we talked about that before. It's one of those dams that's really a challenge because it's operated with detainer gates. Flows reach a certain level, they lift the gates out of the water. The Corps of Engineers has no choice but to operate the dams that way under open river conditions. To maintain the gates, they would be flooding, creating flooding problems upstream. That's how they operate. All the dams are required to do that by law. At that lock and dam, even though it's less frequent than others, it still happens once in 7 years on average. Sometimes it only happens for a day or two. This last summer, 2011, they had the gates out of the water for over a month and a half. And at a time when the silver carp especially want to migrate, when the water bumps up, that's when the fish are moving. So that is going to occur at that lock and dam. An effective barrier at the lock and dam two lock chamber would potentially slow those fish down, assuming we don't have immediate years of high water where they have to pull the gates out. But it would not prevent those fish from becoming established upstream. There's also been discussions about a deterrent barrier at the Hastings Bridge, downstream from Lock and Dam 2. It actually would be a great site, but it's over 1,000 feet across. And an electrical barrier would be very, very costly. To put some numbers on this, to give you an example, in the Chicago Ship Canal, the Corps of Engineers has built two electric barriers. They have to build two, because if one goes down for maintenance, they have to have a backup. And they've spent $40 million, approximately, building those two barriers. And that is a 160-foot-wide channel that's about 20 feet deep. So if you extrapolate that kind of technology to a 1,000-foot section of river, I can't imagine what the cost of that might be. Similar to Lock and Dam 2 is the mouth of the St. Croix River. Again, another potentially good spot because it's a constriction there at Prescott. And all the water has to go under the railway bridge, under the dam. Under the highway bridge there. But it's over 550 feet across, and it's deep across there as well. So the sound bubble technologies are maybe going to slow some fish down, but they've never been tested on any kind of large river system like that. On a small system, they still allow fish to pass. So that's a very, very risky and unlikely to be effective solution to use that technology at a site like that. And then you bring the electrical into it, and the costs are astronomical. Start thinking about what you might be able to do with that funding in other places, especially knowing that that barrier, even electric, is likely not to be 100% effective barrier over a long period of time. Plus, the St. Croix has very high recreational traffic. It is one of the highest used river sections on the Mississippi River in its entirety, and there would be some significant safety concerns there. And also, there's a lot of movement of native species between the St. Croix and the Mississippi River. We think that's quite important, a barrier that would affect that. So there's a lot of issues with that. So after a lot of consideration, our recommendations would be to, our priority would be to fund a constructive deterrent barrier at Lock and Dam 1, Lock Chamber, as soon as we can. Recognizing that there's a lot of issues that need to be worked through, and it really is a Corps of Engineers structure, and ultimately I think would be Corps of Engineers' decision as to whether that would go into place. You have set aside some funding that you talked about this morning, specific to the St. Croix River, requires a 50% match. Wisconsin is really not interested in cost sharing. Wisconsin has taken the approach that it's unlikely to be able to stop fish there, and the dam 50 miles upstream is our critical barrier at Taylor's Falls. We can't get past that dam. MnDOT has offered to work with us that there may be some funding available, up to $5 million. For a deterrent barrier. This would be tied to navigation. They would require a 20% match, and it would be predicated on keeping the Upper St. Anthony Falls lock open, even if we detected or had Asian carp immediately below there. So it precludes your ability to look at a lock closure. And also, I understand there's $5 million proposed in the governor's bonding bill, so there is some funding potentially available. So just really quickly in conclusion, Funding for a deterrent barrier and locking Dam 1 is our top priority because we think it could be the most effective long-term and help stop fish from getting into the upper Mississippi. Deterrent barriers to protect the Minnesota at Locking Dam 2 and the St. Croix are unlikely to be effective to justify the costs. And this funding could potentially be spent in other areas, for example, the lab that Dr. Sorensen talked about. And then emergency closure authorization for Upper Santa Fe Falls remains the best ecological option, knowing that there's still difficulty. I don't know, Commissioner, if you have anything to add or...
Again, Mr. Chairman, members of the Council, Tom Langer, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Just a couple of things. First and foremost, I want to offer that, you know, we often hear these technical reports about what can and what can't work. And I want you to be very clear. We see this as a real problem, and we want to do everything we can to stop slow-aging carp. And so as part of that analysis, we have to look at what will work. We will have limited resources, and we need to put those resources where they will do the most good. In a world where we didn't have to worry about resources, we would put money in things where we have a 10% probability of success. In a world of limited resources, we need to focus on the highest possible barriers. You all have been hearing up till now mostly about barriers, but I think Dr. Sorensen's presentation makes you aware that if we really want to get serious at the state about controlling invasive species, Asian carp, silver carp in particular, we need a basket of things. Barriers, deterrent barriers are one part of that, but absolutely research, monitoring, education are all part of that. And when we've done an analysis to look at what a program like that might cost, including research, you'd be looking at $15 million a year ongoing. Now, part of the reason you all haven't heard that, of course, is because this funding source is not the funding source for research and operations and other types of activities. So set that aside and recognize that there is a lot more that can be done. When we look solely at the possibility of deterrent barriers, we really are faced with a sort of cost-benefit analysis. Now, these are all probabilities of success. When you hear all of these things that are possible barriers, they have a probability of success around it. And, of course, we haven't mentioned Coon Rapids Dam, but Coon Rapids Dam is currently under modification to improve that as a barrier as well. But if you look at, as Tim suggested, the other barrier options, they have anywhere from a 0% of success, we wouldn't put any money in Locking Dam 3, for instance, to a very high level of success, and one we probably can't quantify. And that level of success is not only on an annual basis, but over a longer term. So, for instance, Locking Dam 2, if on average the floods render that ineffective 1 out of 7 years, well, that might be good for 14 years, might be good for 30 years, but might be good for 1 year. It's a probability that we don't have a way of measuring. Locking Dam 1, probably still not 100% effective, but still has some high level of effectiveness. So I think, the challenge that we are all facing is how much will we commit to this effort? And of the amount we're willing to commit, where are we going to put it? And so that you all don't have to wrestle with that whole thing, but in terms of barriers, as Tim has identified, we currently have $13 million pending among three different funding sources, $3 million for Outdoor Heritage, from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, $5 million for possible federal money from the Department of Transportation, and $5 million possible in the governor's bonding budget. So $13 million. If you look at the presumed costs of some of these things, I've seen an electric barrier estimate of $3.5 million. I don't believe that's probably adequate. If we look at $5.5 million, which is our estimate for a deterrent barrier, you can get two of them for $11 million, and we still have $2 million left over. So we are, from the standpoint of barriers, right now, not looking at a huge additional need for funding. Even if we wanted to construct three bubble electric barriers, we'd be in the range of $16 million, $17 million, and we're already at $15 million. So from the standpoint of just a barrier application, we've got a significant amount of money pending to carry out some of those activities. But again, we need to think of the larger package of activities that need to be done, and much of that will be on the breadth of this council. So I just want to say, you know, again, we are absolutely committed to doing what we need to do to stop aging carp. We need to be smart about what we do, and we look to you for your assistance in helping us resolve that. The cost of doing nothing is absolutely going to be thousands of times more expensive than the cost of doing something. So we want to do something. We just want to be smart about it.
Great. Questions? Jim?
Thanks, David. Tim, I didn't understand what you said about that. If we put something at Lock and Dam 1, that would preclude closing St. Anthony. I didn't understand what you said there.
Yeah, the MnDOT money is federal money, and it's tied to an application. So if that federal money was used through MnDOT, then that would preclude your ability to close the lock. It's one of the stipulations that you would not be able to close the lock because you would be shutting down navigation at the Upper St. Anthony Falls or Lock and Dam 1 site. So that money, if it's used, would prevent you from down the road having that option of closing the lock if you wanted to put that into your toolbox again.
So what is the DNR's position on that?
Well, I would throw out another scenario that we thought about, and if you were to put a barrier in the Lock and Dam 1 lock chamber and set up a really good monitoring program in the lock and upstream. They have some really good sonar, some good camera equipment, extensive monitoring, and be able to document if a fish gets through there, if an Asian carp gets through there. You could then trigger a lock closure at Upper St. Anthony Falls because a fish has bypassed your barrier. I know one option that's being talked about is to put a barrier in Upper St. Anthony Falls as kind of a duplicate, a way of preventing the fish, but you could also do that by managing the lock chamber itself. If the electrical barrier, in fact, worked as promised, as you know, the contractors are saying they're going to work, that no fish will get through, then you'll never have to close the lock. It becomes a mute issue because no fish have ever gotten through. So having the ability to close the lock, I believe, is very important as a tool long-term. If you lose that, and we find out that, hey, they in fact got past the electrical barrier, what's going to stop them from getting past an electrical barrier at the next dam? We don't know that they'll do that, but that's a potential. So, I mean, I would just throw that out as another scenario of how you might manage the system, and then you know, you'd have some funding available because you're not putting a barrier at Upper St. Anthony. You have one in a lock chamber, Lock and Dam 1, and then you could maybe invest in some of the other things that, like we've heard about this morning. Just some additional thoughts on it.
Ryan?
David, I've heard no mention about the Minnesota River. Are we throwing that to pardon upon the wolves?
No, not at all. And it's the tough one because the whole Lock and Dam 2 and the mouth of the Minnesota, it's a huge, broad floodplain, and there really isn't anything physically we could do there. What we are doing, though, in the Minnesota River is our fisheries crews in the Minnesota Basin are looking right now at all of the tributaries, places that they think are priorities where we want to make sure we can prevent or we can concentrate Asian carp should they get into the system. For example, are there lake series that we can protect with a barrier like Dr. Sorensen talked about? So identify those critical tributaries where we could actually stop them from getting into key priority resources. And also locations where they would naturally congregate that we could deliver some of the technologies that we hope to develop Dr. Sorensen talked about, some of the poisons and things like that, so you can concentrate and remove the fish. So, in many regards, prevention into the Minnesota River, very, very, very little chance that could ever be successful, and you could spend a whole lot of money trying it. Control and management is a solution there, and then isolated locations where we can physically do something like a barrier that makes sense to protect an important lake or to protect an important tributary. Because of the way that tributary mouth is, you can physically put something there. Those are the things that we're best for the Minnesota River.
Danny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either for the Commissioner or Mr. Schlagenhahn. So if I understand you right, and I agree, the lock and dam at Hastings has been lifted I think maybe three or four times in my 59 years. I'm not sure where you come up with every 7 years. I did hear every 8 years, and I was wondering. And I don't think that takes into account the U.S. Corps' acknowledgement that they could manipulate the opening of the gates and change that sum. I think that's pretty well known. But and I understand, I think we should have the discussion. Do we think it makes sense to spend, who knows, say $6 million just for discussion to put a temporary deterrent to protect the entire upper Minnesota and Mississippi, or is that a roll of the dice we shouldn't make? And it's a really tough discussion, you know, would we be better to invest that money in some zebra mussel or some more boat washing facilities or put more people at the boat landings to protect the zebra mussel? I guess I don't know. But I'm wondering, I'm really nervous about this group funding the kind of research that Dr. Sorensen needs. Unfortunately, we made the mistake of changing LCCMR funding and aligning it to every other year, and that money's not available to us right now. But there is a tool available to us that we could fund money for something that is appropriate for this body to fund that is currently being funded under LCCMR. I mean, specifically, I know there's a $1.6 million RIM project there that we have made it a very strong priority of ours to fund, that we could realign that, fund that project, for instance, free up LCCMR money, which appropriately has been spent for things like Dr. Sorensen's work. I'm just wondering, is it the agency's thoughts that a redirection or using some money off the bottom line to get some more money to AIS from this group? We were said when we voted yes in 2008, we were interested in protecting, enhancing, and restoring. And are you willing to say that we should align another, I'll just pick a number, if we can find $5-6 million more in this budget to spend towards AIS? And this group would need to meet again. I think it should meet with LCCMR jointly and have a discussion. And are we willing to commit to Dr. Sorensen? If we're not going to spend the money for Dr. Sorensen, forget the barriers. They're not barriers, they're deterrents. They're not going to close the lock and dam at St. Anthony. I'm sorry. It's not happening. Would I love it? Kim, would you love it? Would the commissioner love it? Absolutely. Sorry, that's wishful thinking. It's probably wishful thinking on my part to think we'll get a barrier in one of these locks in time. But I guess my one question is, do you want us to try and find another $5 or $6 million from this budget to push LCCMR to find a way to fund Dr. Sorensen? And are you willing to go do an RFP immediately and push the Corps of Engineers? And let's actually put something in now. Is it a risk? Absolutely. But what if it works? What if we deter them for a few years and they hit a home run like they did on the Lamprey? Why do we want to have that ugly YouTube? This is Minnesota. If we can't spend a dollar a person, we voted yes in 2008 to do this, and you guys should be there saying we need to get $6 million and get these folks to say yes. $3 million, that's an embarrassment. It's 3% of what we're spending, $97 million, and we're spending $3 million.
Representative McMurphy, I think something to help you put this in perspective budget-wise and kind of how modest I think the proposals that we've even been talking about in the Great Lakes. They've got the same problem. They've got a resource that they want to protect in the Great Lakes. They've got a large population of carp downstream in the Illinois River, and they've got a zone in there they're trying to manage and trying to figure out where they are. And they are spending, they've spent in the last 2 years $100 million to deal with detection and monitoring. They've spent $8 million alone on eDNA so they could test, they could learn from it, they could study it. You know, we have nothing like that as far as resources. They've spent, they have the full support of the federal government and many FTEs. Just to give you a perspective of the scale of what is understood to be needed to address this problem in the Great Lakes. And our problem, we don't have an eminent large population knocking right at the door right now, but we are very likely to have that. So our problem is going to be the same as theirs. So as much resource as we can put into this, and I totally agree, my position is the knowledge is empowering. As Dr. Sorensen said, the knowledge is also critical. We simply don't have the knowledge capacity either because we don't have those resources to generate that for our area. So the barriers will slow things down, maybe give us a little time. The long-term solution is the ability to manage these fish when they're here and understand how to understand them and continue to shoot for eradication as a tool. But that tool will not be in our toolbox until we have been able to put enough resources and time into studying what that actually looks like. So there are locations, though, that you know we can stop the fish, likely with the barrier, and have a backup. And there are others that we could slow them down, but we also could think about how we spend the money differently. Maybe the commissioner wants to weigh in on it, but personal perspective would be, you know, learn how to deal with the fish, deal with the problem long term, invest in habitat, invest in water quality so our native species have the best chance, put the barriers where they we know they're going to be effective, and continue to try to learn through this. And that could include, you know, could include the sites that we've talked about.
Chairman, thank you. If I could just, Tim, and I don't mean to be a cynical, but to steal from Representative Lugenius, we spent $1 billion on the Minnesota to clean up the habitat. So to say we're going to create the habitat on the Minnesota so game fish will thrive and carp won't, I know it's wishful thinking that all of us here would love to see, but I think we have to consider the deterrence and the science that may work as we try and continue to clean it up.
Jane?
Whatever amount of money we're talking about from this, the recommendation from this council, when would it become available? And when would an RFP be in hand? And when would a project be ready to start?
Maybe I'll try to tackle that one. You know, typically when we get a legislative appropriation, it's available July 1, but sometimes the legislature can make it available immediately upon passage. I don't know what maybe one of the representatives could give it thought about when that would be. We would not, you know, say typically we would not do an RFP until we had the money in hand, and it costs money for us to put an RFP together. It costs money for an entity to apply to that RFP, and we don't want to create those expenditures if we don't have some assurance of it. My sense is that there will be something done this year with respect to the Asian carp control, and so I wouldn't be adverse to proceeding with an RFP. And I can assure you we want to do everything with due haste, but I also need to make everyone aware that there are obstacles or hurdles in the way that we will have to jump that are going to be quite challenging, and not the least of which is when we're working with the federal government on a lock that is a national security issue. They don't just shut the doors and tell us to go and start working on it. And when you look at these electrical barriers in particular, they talk about removing concrete from the bottom, putting the electrodes in and putting more concrete in. And that's not something you do overnight. And so we're talking about barge traffic interruption. So there's a whole host of issues in the NEPA process, National Environmental Policy Act process, that we have to go through. All of these things take an extraordinary amount of time. We've gotten some assurance from the federal agencies that they will work with us to facilitate that. But my sense of the probability of having something into a, you know, locked by this shipping season, almost zero. And I'm just trying to be realistic. I'm not trying to be a doomsayer here. I just don't see how reasonably, realistically, money, permitting, federal concurrence is going to line up by May.
Well, and Jane, just to be clear, we're talking about money that doesn't start to come into the state until July 1st of 2012. So, you know, an early passage of this bill that we've worked on that currently has $3 million in it lets the DNR know they have $3 million starting July 1st, but there's no way to get that money to them before that because it doesn't exist before that.
No, the federal money that DOT has, they're sitting on that right now. But one of the things we have to find out about that DOT money, too, is what obligations come with that. You know, federal money always comes with strings, and some of it is permitting and environmental review and all that kind of thing. And if by taking that money, we launched into an 18-month environmental review process, 24-month environmental review process. You know, that's problematic of itself. So the federal money is currently available, but the strings that come with it might be so onerous we might want to say, maybe not.
You see, my problem about cart before the horse is, you know, my experience has always been you have an RFP before you start assigning dollars to it. You know what I mean? It seems like we're doing it backwards, but that's just me.
So let me, Denny, and then I'll get to Wayne.
Well, just to that point, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hackbart is in the audience, and thank you, Representative Hackbart, for being here. He has a bill that he wants legislative action right away, and if that bill was to pass with some funding for aquatic invasive species, specifically a barrier, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Becker, there is money on the bottom line available immediately that if we funded that, signed it, legislature passed it, this body's already recommended it, the governor signs it, an RFP could be happening simultaneously. Commissioner, you did get $5.6 million. If we're willing to commit and really get moving on this and make sure that the money's there, this can be happening simultaneously. Now, could the Corps drag it and knock us down? Possibly. But I believe there is money in the checking account to fund it.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, the cash flow is not a problem. We have reserves from prior years that could be devoted to this. So an immediate date of enactment available on enactment is a possibility.
And I stand corrected.
Okay. That's the first.
Oh, no, it's absolutely not.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, just knowing, the commitment of the funding entities to proceed with something, I will just commit today that we will start on developing RFP today.
Wayne?
Mr. Chair, I keep looking at this as like the start of a movie of Jaws or Piranha or something like that. You know, we start coming in, dropping nuclear bombs to kill them all because they're so bad. And I'm wondering, at what point do we call it's too much to handle and we shut everything down? I realize that barriers are there and we've got a lot of controls and a lot of other people have had no success in doing things. 10 years from now, we have them where we don't want them. And now they become a viable part of the population. At what point do we say, no, we got to shut down the whole system, fix what's there? I don't care if we poison the whole river system to stop it and replenish it, or what do we do? But is it this severe? Is it this bad that we at some time are going to have to look at saying, we've got a problem, we need to shut all the system down and then fix what we could fix it? Now, the question has been asked me before. I said, well, maybe the best thing to do is go down to the Iowa border. Let's put one system up, shut all barge traffic, and then we don't have a problem anymore.
Wait, Mr. Chairman, too late for that. I mean, I see two future scenarios. One is one in which we have to figure out how to live with Silver Carp. And, you know, we have new systems and we have new ways of recreating. Everybody has a gate up on the front of their boat on the river, and we look like they do down in Illinois. And the other scenario is one that we, I think, are facing with Purple Blue Stripe. It was not that long ago, coming into the cities on Highway 7 from the west, you drive by the wetlands in Minnetrista and Minnetonka, and there was purple loosestrife absolutely everywhere. And through some, you know, really ground-level activity that started with research, we found a parasite that will attack loosestrife and nothing else. And when you come in on Highway 7 from the west now into the cities, you don't see the purple loosestrife like you used to see it. So, by design, conservationists have to have some degree of optimism, and I do, that we can find a way to control or at least live with reduced populations in the future. And so I think I don't know when we get to that point. Wayne, maybe we will, but we're not there yet. So I'd say let's do what we can while we can, and not 10 years from now be saying, geez, I wish we had spent that other $5 million.
Scott?
You know, obviously there's multiple issues. You have the research end of that.
The second one is the strings that might come with the federal money. But did I, if the strings with the federal money are doable, I mean, did I understand you correctly that the two highest priority deterrent barriers that you're proposing at $6 some million apiece or $5 some million apiece that you would actually have if that federal funding was available, that you'd have the funds with the with what's already been allocated to construct the two highest priority deterrents that are on your list?
Well, to clarify, there are three pots of money right now that are either there or pending, and $5 million is the money that's currently available through the Department of Transportation from federal sources. As Tim mentioned, that's to keep trucks off the road, essentially. So that money is available in that Lock and Dam 1 area, the St. Anthony Falls area, where we would be able to maintain barge traffic, so we would not put more trucks on the road as a result of putting a barrier in there. So that $5 million is available for those that one or two projects. The council has approved, recommended $3 million that is pending. It's not available, obviously. It's still pending. And the governor has proposed $5 million in his bonding bill. He's got $12 million invasive species, aquatic invasive species initiative. $5 million of that is for barriers. So, you take, of course, that hasn't even had a hearing yet, the bonding bill, so that's a speculative $5 million. The $3 million from Outdoor Heritage Fund is a speculative $3 million. But if you took all three of those in combination, it's $13 million. The estimates we have right now for deterrent barriers are in the range of $5.5 to $6 million apiece. So $13 million would fund presumably two of those, installation of two of those barriers.
And where would you guys put those two barriers? Just so I understand the priority.
We would put them where directed by the moment. Seriously,
you haven't been in this job that long. Quit being a politician.
Well, to Tim's point earlier, the single most realistic location is Lock and Dam 1. That's the Ford Dam, and that would be the one that I think makes the most sense to do first. If we were to do a second one, I think then we have to look at the trade-offs between, well, St. Anthony Falls, Lock and Chamber, or Lock and Dam 2. Lock Chamber. Of course, St. Anthony Falls makes for triple redundancy because we would have one at Lock and Dam 1, at Ford Dam, we have the Coon Rapids Dam, and Lock, St. Anthony Falls is between those two. So perhaps it would be better to take on the probability of success at Lock and Dam 2, knowing we're giving some protection to the St. Croix and the Minnesota River. But it's we honestly have not had that discussion. If there were two, where would we? Lock and Dam 1 is clearly number one.
Lock and Dam 2 wouldn't do anything for the St. Croix, though. It's only the Minnesota and Mississippi. Just making sure I understand it. Jim?
Thanks, David. Commissioner, I assume you consulted with the governor when he proposed did his bonding proposal, and he only put $5 million in there for barriers, so apparently you felt that was all that was necessary for barriers?
Without crossing my boss, let me just offer what we propose to the governor and what the governor recommends are not always necessarily the same.
I am Scott.
This is a newsworthy item.
Scott?
You know, we talk about the three pots of money, and they are, you know, supposedly available at these different forward time periods. I mean, if all of those funds were available, could you get the permitting? I mean, to make sure I'm clear, the permitting would probably restrict you from doing anything until all of those funding sources would be available anyway, correct?
Tim may want to add to this, but when we start proceeding with an RFP, it's my expectation that we will also start working down the road with permitting. Now, it's very hard to get a permit until you can say specifically what it is you're going to do, but we can certainly start the discussions that we'll need with Corps of Engineers, and we can have those discussions based on two scenarios. One, no federal funding, or two, with federal funding. And if there's a way to expedite by not using federal funding, it would be my recommendation that we do that.
Brian?
I'm sorry, Tim.
Well, I was just going to add some additional information that Bob just passed on, that the Department of Transportation funding was $5 million, but $1 million of that is a 20% state match, so there's $4 million, but still within the range. And then also, understand that yesterday, I wasn't there, but contractor proposed a rough budget for electrical bear at $3.5 million in the lock chamber at lock and dam number one. Now, you know, I don't know if that included valuation and operation and maintenance, which is what we are incorporating into our budget estimates. You got to operate the system for some time after you install it. So I think the point being that what the commissioner was saying, the costs and the range of potential funding available would allow us to do a couple of areas.
So the $5 million federal DOT is actually $4 million, and another $1 million from the state. Okay.
Yes.
We just got corrected by the Department of Transportation too now as well. So
good.
You know, we had hopes, but
Ron.
David. We just heard from Dr. Sorensen. I would like to ask my legislative colleagues here on the council, Denny, what's the status of the proposal to have the University of Minnesota initiate a research facility? Has the legislature taken a look at that yet?
Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Shera, the legislature has not heard that yet. This is the first presentation that Dr. Sorensen has done. Representative Lagenius has a bill kind of aligns with Dr. Sorensen's proposal, but her bill has got a little more long-term vision. Dr. Sorensen was laying out just the funding for a shorter term than Representative Lagenius. Representative Lagenius, I think her total bill, Dr. Sorensen, is in the $4.8 million range. Her and I visited yesterday on that, and it identified that potentially her bill identifies money coming from LaSard, SAMS, and from clean water, potentially. I raised a point earlier about the discussion. Maybe we could think about other funding that I believe is really appropriate from this body that's currently being funded under the existing LCCMR funding, such as the $1.6 million for RIM, is more appropriate, I think, being funded here, and then it would maybe temporarily free up some LCCMR money in the short term with the ideas thinking going forward that future LCCMR funding could come from funding Dr. Sorensen's work. I don't think Dr. Sorensen's going to be able to attract the key professor potentially needs with the idea that, well, we got funding for the next 6 months or the next year. I think a professor, if he's going to come to Colton, Minnesota, is going to want to know he's going to be here for a little while.
Thank you, Dave. To Ron's question, yes, we do. I do have a bill on my desk that addresses the University of Minnesota proposal that we have heard. So that will get the ball rolling. I guess I didn't even inform Denny of that, but it's still just fresh on my desk today or yesterday. So we are definitely serious about that. I talked to the doctor out in the hallway just before the meeting today, and assured him, at least the way I feel, that we have to continue this. We can't just stop this with 1 or 2 years. We have to be looking long-term, and I'm sure Denny will agree. A minimum of 10 years. We have to have a funding source every year once we get the startup money and continue with this. It just only makes good sense. So it is moving in that direction, yes.
Bill, just a clarification. Where does the money come from that's on the bill on your desk? Does it come from us, from the LaSard SAMS?
I'm not sure exactly how it's written. Mike, you can probably help me with that, but it's not, I don't believe.
It's through LCCMR.
Through LCCMR, that particular one. Okay. We've got several of them that we're talking about.
Right,
so that one there pertains to LCCMR. And I know LCCMR has done a lot of science and research over the past year. It seems to be a good fit, at least to me. And I think Denny would agree with that. So, but if I could just make some comments, I'm glad to hear the commissioner say that he would start with the RFP immediately. For a little while there, you weren't willing to do that, but I'm glad you are, because I think, frankly, if we're going to take this serious, and I think the governor, to his credit, has at least had some pretty good thought going into this with the three different meetings he's had. But I'm very frustrated when I hear that we, you know, our dam up comes with the federal government. It's always the federal government. And I think we need to do our due diligence here, get these projects funded show the people of Minnesota that we're willing to do that. And if the feds drop the ball or they drag their feet and we get all infected because they're dragging their feet, they take the hit, not the Sarge Sams, not the Senate or the House, or the DNR for that part, or the commissioner, or the governor. And I think the governor's willing to go that extra mile. Is that fair? Is that fair?
Absolutely correct, Senator Jurgensen. And the core, through Colonel Michael Price, who is the St. Paul District Colonel, has committed they will do everything they can. So everybody is saying they will do the right thing. Of course, the proof is in the pudding, but I agree 100%. The state should do what we can do as quickly as we can, and not let somebody else pull us up.
And just a follow-up. I'm very concerned about what Wayne talked about is, you know, are we going to get this done or aren't we going to get this done? You know, how many times are we going to have to come back and talk about it? Let's move on. Let's get this funded properly. If it's as serious as they say it is, we can't sit on our hands any longer. And if we can somehow find some money available to move this forward, I think we have to exhaust everything we can to get that going. If we have to pay somebody back later on, what's wrong with that? With a bonding bill. I just don't understand it. You can borrow. Maybe you can't borrow on bonding bills, but nevertheless, I don't think too many people are going to stand in the way, at least in our body, for a $5 million bonding situation for something that could come over here and ruin the fishing industry and the resort industry. So,
Leanne?
Just kind of a little different angle on this. Mr. Scherer asked earlier about the legislature, and I guess I just want to express a little disappointment. I'm glad that we're talking about this as a group and Lassard and the LCCMR, but I really feel that the legislature should be stepping up and funding this straight up. And I know that these pots of money exist, and that's part of why we're here and doing this, but I just want to express my frustration that, and challenge to the leadership that we make an effort to really go after this straight up and do the right thing and fund it in our main environmental budgets as well. So, thank you.
Danny?
Can I piggyback on Representative Lowy's point? Commissioner, if we were to get a fishing license increase or a boating AIS fee increase, would part of that money potentially be available for some AIS work?
Well, to date, the numbers that have been proposed in terms of the fishing increase or the AIS increase have been identified for activities that don't include Asian carp. The fishing increase would fund just our ordinary fisheries operations. The AIS surcharge was intended primarily for zebra mussels. Now, because we don't have either of them right now, certainly those totals could be reappropriated, but it would mean redirect, but it would mean giving up those things that we had originally proposed under the bills. Now, because neither of those, again, has been passed, certainly the numbers could be increased. You know, fishing, you could throw a dollar surcharge on a fishing license, for instance, and raise more than $1 million. You could double the AIS surcharge and get another $8 million a year. So certainly we could look at doing that, but the way that they were originally proposed last year, there was not Asian carp elements in there.
Jim?
Just a quick question. How is the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District funded, and what is their yearly budget? Does anybody know?
I believe based on my tax statement, property tax statement, it just comes out of property tax. They're a special unit of government, and they get funded that way, but it seems like you get $1 million from me, so I don't know who else.
You're a big property owner.
You have no idea?
I have no idea what the Metro budget is.
Well, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Landwehr stated it correctly. I don't know the total budget per year. It was pretty high at one point, and then I think some of it was moved over to affordable housing or whatever in the metropolitan area. But it is a local property tax. It's a joint powers, and there's a local property tax legislature allowed in the metropolitan area to fund the mosquito control.
And what was the budget at one time? What was the high?
I want to say it was in the $4 to $5 million range, but I don't know what it is today.
Okay, so thank you guys for all the information. I think we're at a point of figuring out what, if anything, we want to do. As I see it, and somebody can propose different options, but from what I see, we have sort of two basic choices. One is to say we've put our recommendation forth to fund $3 million for this effort. Our bill has here what we actually have in the bill, which is $3 million in the second year to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to control Asian carp to protect Minnesota's aquatic habitat. Use of this money requires a one-to-one match for projects on state boundary waters. So that's, we don't have limitations on location, I think. We've allocated $3 million and an accomplishment plan comes back to us for a specific location. So we can either stay with that or we can look at expanding funding. There are a couple of things there. We can have a discussion about whether we want to be in the research business or not. I suspect there's strong feelings about that, but it's a discussion that we can have. Or we can talk about adding to the recommended appropriation and increasing it above $3 million to some other amount. Obviously, if we do that, we either have to dip into the 5% or a little better than 5% budgetary fund balance, or we have to reallocate from other projects. And I think that's sort of what we have to discuss and figure out. What do we want to do, if anything? So I'll open it up to members.
But David, but what are we allocating it to? I mean, we have no proposal. Are we just giving them a blank check for?
At this point, what we're doing is allocating $3 million to Asian carp, subject to an accomplishment plan that has to come back to us.
Okay, but on the additional monies then, I mean, what are we allocating them
we
to?
We can decide what we want to do. If anything, we can add it to this. We can recommend a more specific program. It's up to us to present a recommendation to the legislature, which they can then choose to accept or not accept.
A question for Bill. Bill, when we were talking in the past, we've had carryover funds every year. How many of those? How much of the carryover funds did we end up having to use in any of those years for one reason or another because there was a shortfall in our projected budget?
At the height of the recession, we had to use approximately $2 to $2.5 million because of a shortfall in sales tax. And it was only used in the accounting sense.
So in reality, the 5-6% that we have sitting there that we're putting into this year's budget realistically is going to be there unless we have a problem with the...
Yeah, unless there's a problem. And yeah. You know, you're talking from July 1st, 2012 to June 30th, 2013, so...
And lately, a couple of years ago, we budgeted for a project which was up in the North Woods, the Blandon,
yep.
Crop for the forest project. And I think what we did is we committed to half now, and then we half later, half the following year. I'm just trying to see about all the different possibility scenarios that might lay out here we could do.
The only difference, and Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was in a biennium budget cycle. And this would be, if you were to look at anything future, you're talking about a different cycle, which we can't, and the legislature can't do. This legislature can't bind future legislatures.
Okay. Mr. Bill? Chair, I'm sorry that Tom and I had to be over the session. Has there been any discussion or has there been any thought, and maybe Greg, you can help us with this, with constitutionally wise,
There's been talk of any money coming from the Clean Water Fund to help out.
Greg or Janelle, do you know anything or have any thoughts?
Do they have a bottom line there? How much do they have?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Richardson, the bottom line there is less than what you have in the bottom line. One for finance earlier talked about the getting down. They're down to about the 3% level. You're talking about 5%. They recommend about a 5% carry forward. But those funds in Clean Water were taken down to about 3% last session, and they were appropriated for the entire biennium, so both fiscal years. So there's less money available there than there is here.
Out of the reserve.
Yes, out of the reserve.
Just to follow up, is there a way to capture that money now to help offset the cost on this side? In other words, in order, I know it's already been appropriated, but you have some bottom line money there. Can some money be appropriated from there now to help with the situation we're talking about?
Well, Mr. Chair and Bill, you would have to reduce an appropriation from that or take it from that 3% credit board. Okay. You'd have to reduce an appropriation to some existing in the second year of the biennium to something that you've already appropriated the money for. And you also have a different council. I mean, you as chair of the committee can do what it wants, but as far as this group, you don't have any authority over that fund. That's a different group that has the authority over that fund.
Right.
Denny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there may be an updated financial analysis of the Clean Water Fund that may show a little bit more on their bottom line than their previous projection. As if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Becker, don't we have an updated number that we have a little bit more money in most current numbers?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, the Outdoor Heritage Fund you have in your packet, the staff's rendition of the updated fund statement. There were some errors. If there are errors in the Clean Water Fund, then they would have a new bottom line too, but I don't know exactly what it is.
But Bill, isn't our number a little bit bigger than we thought a few months ago, like some hundred thousands more or something?
It's about 300,000 more, and if we took it down similar to the Clean Water Fund, we could appropriate $2 to $3 million in.
Well, Mr. Chair, and it's my understanding at some point, I don't know how you want to do this, if you do want to break for lunch or we can maybe do it right now. I believe Mrs. Schmidt from the Trust for Public Land would like to come forward at some time and talk about a new development in Mississippi Northwoods that potentially could free up some of our previously allocated money, and if we took some from the bottom line and looked at potentially making a stronger commitment to the whole EIS issue with the idea, I personally think that maybe some temporarily, if we would relook at maybe a project that LCCMR was funding that we could fund that would be appropriate from here and free up some LCCMR money to begin Dr. Sorensen's research. That's a tool that is available to us that doesn't send us down the path of funding research that I'm not sure is appropriate from this group, but our commitment to AIS, just we're in an unfortunate situation where this pot of money is available today to do good work, and it takes a little bit of creativity. Takes the commissioner of DNR to step forward and say, you know, I'll go get an RFP right now. Hopefully they're back there working on it as we talk. So I'd like to propose that we hear what Trust for Public Land has to say and draw the bottom line down to the number that the Clean Water Fund is, and have a joint meeting with LCCMR to put our heads around this quickly and let Senator Engelbertson and Representative Hackbart move bills forward so we can do as Senator Engelbertson said, not be the one somebody points a finger and says, you know, you did what Iowa and Illinois and everybody else did. You let the fish come up here. That we're trying to move it forward. And the governor is the one that's taking the hits right now. He wants to get going on it. I don't think we want to be the group that stood in the way of doing it. It's risky. I know it's risky. It may not end up being the right thing to do, but boy, it could be the right thing to do. And it, we should be the ones doing it.
Susan, do you want to come up?
Mr. Chair, just a quick question because I'm trying to figure out exactly where we are with our agenda. We had a presentation from Peter Sorensen, and it says on the top of that a proposal to create, and it was, appears to have some dollars involved in here. I wanted to know whether that was, it was making a request that we needed to act on separate from the other ones, or it was just information.
Well, you know, we're in a gray area here, but we're not seeking proposals at this point. We don't have an RFP out. So I think it's more information at this point than a proposal to us, because we don't have an RFP process at this point. It doesn't mean we couldn't do something, but I don't want to see it treated as a proposal to us, because it's not our process.
Thank you.
Ron?
Well, I wanted to just echo Dan's remarks, but I'm wondering if our legislative colleagues here on the council, it seems to me, as what I'm hearing, is we have a huge piecemeal approach here. And when I hear the Clean Water Fund, which has just as much money as we do, hasn't spent a nickel, to my knowledge, on the invasive species issue. Maybe it's too new for them. But it seems to me we need a legislative body here that will put together an invasive species war chest, which involves the Clean Water Fund, which involves our money, which involves perhaps a surtax on a surcharge on boating licenses, fishing licenses. I get the Clean Water Fund involved here, if I mentioned that already, and put this all together as a war plan for the state, because we need it badly.
All right.
Before we hear about modifying other projects that are in our current proposed bill, I'd rather look at how much we're talking about from the other creative suggestions that have been brought forward today, such as doing some sort of a swap with LCCMR and looking at reserve money, than modifying our bill any further.
Well, let me just talk about the swap as I see it, and since I was wrong once today, you know, I'm willing to be wrong a second time, and you guys can tell me if I am. But at this point, we've recommended $97 million in expense, leaving us on a proposed basis $5 million in our reserve.
5.3.
I'm rounding to the nearest million. Just if we want to swap something, because we don't want to fund a research proposal, it comes out of that 5.3. There isn't any place else.
Okay.
Swapping means us committing to something else, so someone else could commit to something else. So at this point, we have $5.3 million that we can talk about what do we want to do, unless something else changes. You know, I don't know that we know exactly what we want to do, and in my own mind, I'm struggling with, you know, you've got a bonding proposal, you've got our proposal, and you've got a combination of Department of Transportation, federal and state, that comes up to $13 million. So I'm not sure exactly what we should do. Clearly, there's a sense that we should do something, or we wouldn't have allocated $3 million. Maybe we should allocate more. How much more, I think, is something that we need to talk about.
We need to get Susan up to the
break. So I'd like to bring Susan up, since Denny asked her to come up, and then see where we are, and we probably will break for lunch after that and then come back to finish this discussion, because I don't see us getting through it quickly.
Cafeteria closes at 1.
Oh, yeah, the cafeteria closes at 1, so we will get out of here relatively quickly, or we're going to work without eating.
Mr. Chair, Susan. Members of the council, my name is Susan Schmidt for the record. I'm with the Trust for Public Lands. Are you sure you don't want to break the lunch now and then before the restaurant closes? No, I'm glad to come up and respond. Thank you very much. I had a chance to talk to several of you on the phone yesterday, so this is an opportunity for me to clarify how things have developed over the last 20 hours. But on behalf of the Trust for Public Land, it is facilitating the protection of Mississippi River North Woods, which many of you know is 3 miles of the Mississippi River, 2,000 acres of intact, biologically significant land northeast of Brainerd in Crow Wing County. We really have evolved as a partnership and refined this project over the last several months. And so I'd like to give you updates on two fronts, if I could. One is in regards, we've been working with the county and with our partners, DNR and others, on the management plan, if you will, for the property. And of course, aquatic habitat and wildlife habitat remain the cornerstone of the property, no doubt about it. But we do believe, as we've worked on this management plan, we'd love to bring that into you with a couple of LSOHC members in the weeks to come as we finalize that or get that shaped up. But aquatic and wildlife habitat remain the cornerstone, but we, whereas in the past we might have thought a trail could be a part of the property, we now are convinced that a state trail will be a part of the property. As a part of that analysis, we've worked with the county and the DNR and others to develop an estimate for the trail corridor. We believe that estimate to be $2 million, approximately $2 million. So, an option for the LSOHC to consider today is reducing the appropriate, the recommendation for the Mississippi River North Roads project by that $2 million. Again, an option for you to consider today. Let me assure you that I don't say this lightly, and that I say it knowing that we will all be working together to identify and secure the $2 million approximately that will be needed for that state trail corridor. So we will all need to work on that together. I also have an update on the appraisal, and I just, everybody's asked me about that, and I want to be sure to update you on the appraisal. As you all know, this request is based on an appraisal that was completed according to state law, state rules, state policies. It was under review and certification, as it needs to be by state law, state rules, state policy, by the Department of Natural Resources. But when we changed direction for county ownership, they started the review and approval certification process of the appraisal. Since then, the rules have changed, and the appendix, is it E or F? Bill, help me here.
Appendix E.
E, thank you. That the DNR and the LSOHC have together governing acquisition has changed. So we found out in January that we need to do a second appraisal for any acquisitions above $10 million. So we're working hand in hand with the Department of Natural Resources figure out how to get that next, well, first of all, also according to the changes in the procedures, DNR has to write the appraisal instructions, which is fine. We're trying to figure out how to get them the resources to write that appraisal instruction so that we can start the second appraisal. We're more than willing to do that, but of course it's going to take time and money to do that. And then we're working with DNR to get them the resources they need to review and certify the appraisal. Long and the short of it is, I think it will at least be the end of March, by the time we have a reviewed and certified appraisal, which of course will complete the valuation process. So several of you have asked, I just wanted to update you on that front. Again, we are giving you this update today because of the Trust for Public Land. We think it is the best thing for your recommendations going forward. For me to update you on this information, probably the largest project in your package right now, so that you are having this conversation and I don't bring it up 3 weeks from now or 3 months from now. So that's my intent. We support the package as you propose it today and look forward to working with it as it is approved. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And I, on a personal level, would just say that I recognize the challenge making that recommendation would be for the Trust for Public Land to come in and actually acknowledge that a trail is necessary and or is likely, and funding from somewhere else would be appropriate for that, and therefore a reduction would not be the end of the world to accomplish what's best for that property. That's a courageous thing to do, whatever we decide to do with that. Jim?
But, I mean, on another point, you know, we approved that project without the trail. I mean, and Representative McNamara brought up some very, I think, good points on exactly what how the trail could affect that property. Now you've really changed the whole, you know, dynamic of that proposal. If we agree to this reduction, does that mean we're accepting the trail and we don't even know where the trail is going to be?
It's all for us to discuss.
Okay.
So, I think at this point I'd like to suggest we break for lunch and then come back and have the discussion. Is that acceptable to members?
Yes.
So we will go into recess. Thank you all.
Be back at 1.
Be back at 1.
How long will we be going?
A quick lunch.